From the heart of the city, 103.2. This is Dublin City FM.
Hello and welcome everyone to Science Spinning, the show with an Irish spin on science, with me, Sean Duke, here on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Today in The Question Is, where we put questions to scientists of a challenging nature, I'll be asking Sarah McMurray, who's a retired physics lecturer, why are we not doing so well at maths here in Ireland? In What's It All About, the slot where I ask scientists to explain their research, today I'll be talking to Frank Stamm, he's of the Tyndall National Institute, to explain what electroactive polymers are and how they could potentially be used to save people's lives. And finally, in Inventive Minds, the slot where we talk to scientists that are developing ideas with commercial potential, this week I'll be doing something different and talking to two talented young inventive minds, Owen Killian and Lucas Grange. They're both from Belvedere College in Dublin City, about a project they're working on for the BT Young Scientist and Technology exhibition that's coming up in January next. So let's start by considering how we're doing at maths here in Ireland. There was a time, not so long ago, when we were considered quite good at maths. Unfortunately, according to a new PISA study, that's a study that was done by the OECD, that's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, they're the developed countries of the world, we're now below average, apparently, in maths. And I thought it might be well worthwhile to try and explore a bit more about why that might be the case. So I've invited Dr. Sarah McMurray. She's a retired physicist. She's written a book from TCD, I should say. She's written a book called Mathematics as a Language, and she's here in studio with me. So welcome, Sarah.
Thank you.
So, Sarah, you started in TCD in the 60s, and it says here you retired in 07, so you spent quite a long time involved in physics, and of course maths is very closely linked to physics. So things changed quite a bit over that period, perhaps.
Yes, definitely. And in fact, I always taught maths courses to scientists as well as teaching physics. And initially, of course, we didn't have nearly so many students as we have nowadays. But I'd say 10, 15 years ago, we began to notice that people were coming into college without the same preparation in maths that they'd had. And of course, maths is important when you're doing physics.
Mm. Just as a very general observation, I don't know if it holds water at all, but the last 15 years, of course, were associated with great economic explosion and boom here in Ireland. People got wealthy. That's come to an end, unfortunately. But if you go back to the 80s, maybe we were better at maths in when times were harder. Is there any link between the two, do you think, at all?
Well, one link that we did notice was that, of course, when it was easy to get jobs and part-time jobs, practically all the students were working part-time,
okay,
which meant they weren't spending so much time on their studies as they had when jobs weren't so easy.
Well, maybe that's the key to it, because maths isn't easy for a lot of people. Some are lucky and it comes easily, but it demands work.
It does, but it isn't just an Irish problem. In the whole of the Western world, America and Western Europe, there have been, there's a perception that there's a problem with the maths, and it's partly the teaching, but I think here anyhow it's really driven by the exams and the points race.
You wouldn't be a fan of that, by the sound of things.
No, I used to think that there wasn't a better way of doing things, but as it stands, the points race means that the be-all and end-all is to get good marks in leaving rather than getting a basic good education.
Okay. But the reason, as I understand it, they brought in the points was to try and make it at least fair across the board, you know, that there wasn't any kind of influence to get people into various courses or whatever. So it'd be hard to replace it at the same time, wouldn't it?
Yes. I mean, what we need to replace is the way things are examined, I think. I mean, the trouble is that maths is essentially taught as a set of recipes and you use the appropriate recipe and the appropriate question in the exam and get a good answer. But you don't necessarily understand where the recipe comes from, what the point of it is, or what it means.
Sure, sure. And just to get on to your book then, Maths as a Language, what prompted you to write that? What was your motivation, if you like?
Well, we started a series of tutorials for first-year students coming into physics because they really weren't able to use, and they couldn't remember the maths they'd done at school. And so they were finding the physics extra difficult because they hadn't got the basic maths or they hadn't got it at their fingertips.
So just to, sorry to cut across, but you found that maybe they needed an extra something that really they should have been getting in secondary school, if we're being honest.
That's right, yes. Yeah. Yes, I mean, if they'd understood what they'd done in school, it would have lodged in their brains a bit more, but they would come and you'd ask them a sort of junior cert question and they'd say, I don't remember.
Yeah.
When it should be something that if they'd understood it, they wouldn't be remembering, they'd just know.
Sure. Now, I like your title, Maths as a Language, because I think to me anyway, and probably a lot of people doing maths years ago, was the actual language or the symbols, you know, the sine, cosine, all that kind of stuff was a bit intimidating and made it maybe even more difficult. So is part of it just breaking down that language barrier?
Well, yes. I mean, maths really is a language. It's a symbolic language. And in any language, if you don't understand what the words mean, you can't speak it. So if you don't understand what the symbols mean in maths, there's no way you're going to be able to do it. And your point about cosine and sine is very, we find a lot of them coming in really haven't a clue what they mean at all.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It would be preferable, really, if they'd done less in school but understood what they had done.
Sure, and of course the teachers probably feel they have to move on to more material all the time, and then if somebody doesn't understand it, they get left behind and on.
Yes, I mean, I think the syllabus is quite full, and I think the teachers do have to go quite quickly. But also, I think to a certain extent, students and their parents don't want to, they want to know how to pass the exam, not
be better educated
as
such. So
yeah.
if we were just to kind of summarise what your book is aimed at whom then? Who would be the target audience?
Well, originally I wrote it for our first year students, really.
Okay.
It's the sort of stuff we were doing in tutorials with them.
Sure.
Then a colleague said, oh, it would be good for the young teachers she's training.
Okay.
And a friend who's a secondary school teacher also thought it would be good for teachers.
And what about students at Leaving Cert level?
I mean, it assumes that people have met the topics in the math syllabus at school. So it wouldn't be good for them sort of just starting off, but it might help them when they've covered some of the stuff.
Yes.
It might help them to look back at it. And certainly at Leaving, because most of this is junior cert stuff.
Right.
So it might help Leaving Cert students looking back on their junior cert and perhaps understanding it a bit more.
Okay, and for just to finish off, unfortunately we don't have that much time, but if you had advice then, or you were in a position where you could implement new policy to try and improve standards generally and, you know, get us back up that OECD table, what can we do?
Well, of course, Project Maths is an attempt to do this.
What is that now?
And
listeners might know that.
Project Maths, I mean, it was a sort of experimental session last year, but it's come into the schools now, and it's aiming to teach by problem, through problems really, more than the ordinary math syllabus does.
And by problems, so that you present them with real world problems, is it?
You try and get them to think for themselves.
Okay.
So yes, and you do try and tie it to things that will mean something to them.
Right, and there's a message maybe for teachers, if I could be so bold, is to try and maybe get them to think for themselves rather than spoon-feed them and,
yes,
you know, get them to learn by rote.
Yes, it does take longer.
Okay.
To learn that way.
Well, Sarah, thanks very much for coming in. And just to tell us about the book, it's called Maths as a Language. And if people are interested in it, maybe as a Christmas present, who knows, where can they get it?
They can get it from the library shop in Trinity College.
Library. And where is that in Trinity?
How do you? It's where the Book of Kells is.
Okay, that's easily found.
Yes.
Right. So thanks very much. That was Dr. Sarah McMurray. She's a retired physicist who's written a book called Mathematics as a Language. And for any of you out there leaving certs that are maybe looking for a little bit of a boost coming up to the leaving cert this year or next, it'd be a good read. Thanks very much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Now, next in today's programme, we're going to discuss something called electroactive polymers and what exactly they are and how they can be used to save people's lives. And I'm delighted to welcome to the programme Frank Stamm. He's at the Tyndall National Institute and he leads up a major research project in this area. Hello, Frank.
Hello, how are you?
Can you tell us, first of all, I'm sure that most people have not heard of these electroactive polymers. What exactly are they and why are they important to engineers and why can they be used in medicine?
Well, in this case, electroactive polymers are a material that if you apply a small voltage to it, they can shrink or expand in a liquid environment. So especially because it is in a liquid environment, you would think about the blood system, the circulatory system, where this can be very useful for, say, blocking a vessel that you otherwise wouldn't be able to block unless you do open surgery.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so really, this is all the context for this, of course, is that you're involved in a major research project that's going to try and help develop new medical devices for people that are suffering from heart disease. So at the moment, I mean, people might be familiar with pacemakers and things like that, but what you're looking to develop is something far more sophisticated.
Well, it is less complicated than a pacemaker. A pacemaker would be all electronics and you need battery and you need all that kind of information. But for the gel that we are proposing, it's a material, and the material can act as it on its own. Or if you want, in a more advanced option, you could have the material sitting on a substrate with electrodes, and then you can over time maybe expand or shrink the material.
Okay, so I suppose the big point about these things is that when you apply electricity, they can change their size and their shape to suit whatever needs to be done.
Yeah, and this electrical pulse could in principle be applied when this material enters the body through maybe a catheter system, and then once you remove the catheter system and the electrical system, then the material will stay on its own in the circulatory system.
Okay, well, let's take an example. At the moment, for example, a child with congenital heart disease, we all may be familiar with somebody like that, they have to undergo repeated operations. But with using these new materials, EAPs we'll call them, the number of operations could be reduced. Is that right?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. So in that particular case, what you could do, this child might, for instance, because the system grows, so the blood flow will change, and you might, in this case, restrict the blood flow. So every so often then the child will need an operation to adjust the blood vessels. But with the new electroactive polymer, what you could do is have a ring of that material around the blood vessel, and if you can, say, via inductive power and radio signals affect the swelling and the shrinking of that material, you could do that outside the body, and you don't need a medical procedure for doing that.
Okay, so at the moment we're kind of restrained because if we put something in, a medical device, into the body, then it's in and that's it.
Yeah.
But what you seem to be saying is we're moving on now where we could actually manipulate a material after it's put inside the body so that it continues to be useful, it lasts longer.
Yeah, that's the intention of the project.
Okay. Now, tell me specifically about, there's a project that you're heading up, it's called Heart E-Gel Project, and the Tyndall National Institute, which is a major research institute, of course, down in Cork there, you're heading it up. So this is quite a prestigious thing, 3-year project. What's involved with that?
Well, first of all, there's 8 partners in all in this project. They come from 4 different countries in Europe, including Israel. So in that project, we have medical sites, we have cardiologists, you have then Tyndall and an institute in Tel Aviv. We are looking at the electronic side, so the say, for instance, the electrodes that apply the current to the material. Then we have two institutes that make the material, so they are very good at characterizing the material and see how it behaves in blood. And we have in Ireland another partner, which is Gergana in Galway, and they make the delivery device for bringing the gel into the body. So that will be a customized catheter.
Mm-hmm.
And we have IMEC, a big Belgium consortium, and they do the system integration of getting the electronic side, the material side, and the delivery side all integrated.
Okay, so it's quite an achievement to head up the project, you know, across 8 countries.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Not often that happens in Ireland.
No, and it is a special situation that Ireland is allowed to coordinate this and be in charge of the running of the project.
Okay. Now, can you tell us as well, that I believe that there may be wireless control of some of these medical devices into the future. You know, once they're in the body, you'll be able to change their shape or whatever under wireless control. So that sounds fascinating. Is that a general trend?
Well, for medical situation, it's not that much of a medical of a trend. But in Tyndall, we do a lot of wireless assemblies for applications, say, on the body, so that you can, for instance... say from a remote location, you can activate something or you can monitor some physical conditions. But for this project, what it will involve is that we have in the body some electronics which can be affected from the outside by, like, you don't want a battery there for the rest of its life, so you want to maybe by inductive powering get power into the implant.
Sure. So obviously you can't be putting things into the body where there's batteries involved. So yeah. Now, as you know, but just to inform listeners that cardiovascular disease accounts for about 1/3 of all deaths in the world. You know, that's obviously a huge group. These materials, as they're going to be used over the coming years, I mean, what will be the impact on real people's lives? Will they actually save people's lives, do you think, in the short to medium term?
Well, there's different situations. At the moment, there are a certain group of people that cannot undergo open surgery. Say, elderly people, they might not survive that. So if this material can replace an existing open surgery method with a minimal invasive option, then we can help these people. And so they have a higher mortality case. Then you have the less invasive procedures, means that say there will be less pain, there will be less follow-up problems, and also the cost will be much lower.
Okay, they sound all very positive, and wish you well with the project, and we'll check in from you from time to time, if that's okay. And thanks for coming on the show today. That's Frank Stamm. He's heading up a major project at the Tyndall National Institute across 8 countries called HeartEGel. Thanks very much, Frank. Now, continuing on the cardiovascular theme, I'm delighted to welcome to studio for our Inventive Mind slot today. I've got two young men here today that are going to be exhibiting at the BT Young Scientist and Technology Exhibition, which is coming up in January. It's a fantastic show. The standard seems to be getting higher and higher every year. And I'm delighted to welcome Belvedere College students Owen Killian and Lucas Grange. Welcome, guys.
Hi, how are you?
Hello.
Okay, guys, now I'll get on to your project in a second, but, you know, the show is a huge thing. So obviously, from your perspective, what are the advantages in taking part in a major show like this?
Well, I suppose you get the whole experience of, you know, meeting other people who are interested in the subject that you're interested in, and, you know, participating in that overall atmosphere of science that comes attached with it. It's a fantastic experience. I did it last year. This is Lucas's first year.
Yeah.
You know, again, we just hope to experience that wonderful... there's a relationship that develops between everybody, and you're learning from other people and you're imparting knowledge to people, and in that way you build up your own understanding of what you're doing yourself. It's a fantastic
experience.
Sure,
and there's a great buzz in the hall, isn't there, between students your own age and, of course, people, older people and judges coming over to ask you about the projects. It must be fantastic to be able to present your work to all of those people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a completely different... I mean, it's not about being locked up in the lab anymore with all the circuitry trying to make sense of it. It's getting out there in the open, and it's a very different sort of science. used to that which most people would be used to.
Sure. And Lucas, maybe you could tell us then just about the particular project. The name of it, as far as I can get, is the development of a smartphone-based automated external defibrillator. So again, we're on to the issue of heart disease and trying to help people that may get in trouble with heart disease. But maybe you could explain a little bit more what your project idea is.
Well, basically what we're doing is we're getting a little box that we could apply onto a smartphone. We could plug it in and
I'll stop you straight away. Now, a smartphone, just to explain to listeners that might not know, what is a smartphone?
Basically the iPhone or anything similar. It's basically any phone that can use apps.
Apps are pieces of software that can run on a phone, phone.
It's a smartphone would be closer to a computer than a phone. I mean, yeah.
Okay, sorry, I interrupted. So to continue with your explanation of it.
We have a little tab, a little box we'd apply to the back of the phone and be able to carry it around with the phone. And there'd be a bit of software which you'd be able to apply the pads to a person and the software check whether or not it needs to be a shock applied and then would be able to deliver the shock afterwards.
It sounds fantastic. And Owen, I mean, I'm just going back and forth between the two guys here, but Owen, who do you envisage is actually would go around carrying this? Is this for doctors or is it for lots of people?
Well, you see, the nature of what we're trying to deal with here, which is sudden cardiac death, which is electrical faults in the heart, and it accounts for up to half of all heart-related deaths and diseases in America alone, and so that's a fairly general statistic. It can be applied to most countries. It can happen to anybody. It's not confined to older people.
Younger people have dropped dead at football matches.
Absolutely, it's that whole thing. It's the sport association as well. It can happen to anyone at any time, anywhere. And the problem with the current measures is that you have a very, very hefty defibrillator, which is located in a sports club or located in an airport or a shopping mall. And yet what we want to do is we want to make it much broader. In Portland, Oregon, they introduced defibrillators on the street corners, and the sudden cardiac death-related deaths dropped dramatically. So what we're trying to do is bring that to a new level, the ultimate in portability, carried around by people with basic medical training. So we're talking sports coaches, a lot of teachers, nurses, doctors, anybody who has undergone these first aid courses would be able to handle an automated external defibrillator, and therefore could download this app, could purchase this very simple peripheral which can be attached to the phone and hence go around quite portably with this technology.
It sounds absolutely fantastic. So let's imagine a terrible scenario where you're walking through Dublin and you have one of these phones yourself and somebody just collapses. How will it work in practical terms?
Well, in practical terms, what we'd hope to do is we'd take out the phone, we would attach this device. This device would come with two basic electrode pads. We've all seen them in films and in television. It's the basic idea of attaching it to the chest. And then we would open the app on the phone. And the ideal situation would be then that the app would immediately call 112 or the paramedics.
Okay.
And we'd have a direct line to them so that they'd be conscious of this happening immediately. And, you know, paramedic help would be on the way.
Can you give information about how the heart is behaving to the paramedics? Like, will there be a wireless?
That would be a later step. Again, I must stress that all we're doing is proof of concept.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's ideas, obviously, that a fantastic idea. Like, ideally, maybe you could develop something that could apply a shock there and then if it's needed.
Yeah, exactly. And with the blessing, say, of the paramedics as opposed to the person who's on hand, the people who have the best training. But yeah, we would be administering a shock on site, say a 3-shock protocol, because we're really talking about cutting down weights. So essentially, it's capacitors instead of a heavy battery pack that's built into this unit. And instead of having dedicated circuitry, which will be analysing the heart rhythm, we have a software which is on the phone. So it's about condensing space, and it's about integrating it with something which everybody's familiar with, people carry around in their pockets on a daily basis.
Sure. And Lucas, I mean, I think the figure is something like 70% of people never make it to a hospital when they have one of these sudden cardiac arrests. So hopefully, if a lot of people have these phones, we're going to save a lot of lives.
Well,
potentially.
I mean, it'd be the best. That'd be the ideal goal, basically, to save that 70%.
kind of thing.
Sure, save everyone, of course, if you could. It sounds like something that actually, I mean, I know it's early days and, you know, you have to go through all the stages of trying to develop a product and a prototype and everything. And you're 50 years in school, after all. So is it something that you really seriously are thinking about that, you know, maybe when I finish school that we can really get stuck into this and try and develop it commercially? Or is it more a research project, do you think?
Well, we'd be kind of aiming to get it commercial, but, you know, it's not going to dominate our lives or anything. It's
sure. You're 16, 17. You have other things to be thinking about. Sure. And what are both of your kind of skills, or what are you interested in then?
Well, I suppose I'm bringing the whole medical side to it. I'm passionate about medicine. I certainly definitely intend to study it. And that's really why I wanted to get involved in this project. Lucas is coming more from the engineering background, so we're sort of meeting in the middle in that regard, and we're finding terrible trouble with the computer programming language, but we're struggling through that at any rate.
And is anybody helping you? We're running out of time, but is anybody helping you in terms of maybe trying to develop this into something that's real world?
Well, again, we've a lot of support from the great teachers and staff in the science department in Belvedere, and we're in contact with a couple of universities at the moment who, you know, we'd be trying to get this from a more research point of view. But after the proof of concept, after the young scientist, we'd love to approach some biomedical companies.
Okay, well, anybody listening, there's two very bright young guys here, and I'm sure they'd be delighted to hear from you if you wanted to link up with them in any way. That's all we have time for this week, folks, and indeed for this year. Thanks for listening. I'll be back again in January, on the 13th of January. If you want to go along to the BT show, it starts on the 12th to the 15th of January. It's in the RDS as usual. The two guys will be there, and lots of other people too. It'll be very interesting show as usual, I'm sure. So have a great Christmas, and talk to you again in the new year.